This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today, April 30th, is the fourth annual International Jazz Day, set aside to salute jazz not only as a truly American art form, but for its diplomatic role of uniting people all over the world. So we begin with a classic from 1935, Benny Goodman and Louis Prima's Sing, 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 a major hit for Goodman in the pre-war world of the 1930s. It was just one of the tunes that was his, and just one of the bands that began to change the sound of music, not just in America, but all over the world. Back then, I don't know that people really thought of Sing, Sing, Sing as jazz as much as swing, but swing is certainly a subset of a musical form that grew out of the African-American community and infused music with a new beat, a brasher, freer sound that matched America's coming of age and which captured the imagination of people around the world, crossing cultural boundaries and making inroads with people when political relationships failed. This hour, we talk about jazz then and now, jazz in the Queen City, and more with three people who know it well. You know Kevin Kniestad as WFAE's Morning Edition host, but prior to his arrival here, he spent years on the West Coast as a jazz radio host and blogger in Seattle. He still misses the coffee. We asked him to join us to lend his perspective. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Also with us is Chad Lawson, a Steinway pianist and composer in Charlotte, who has played and recorded a variety of musical styles, from his straightforward and very popular Dear Dorothy the Oz sessions, jazz arrangements of music from The Wizard of Oz, which he performed with his trio, to more New Age free-form music. His latest release, The Space Between, debuted at number 12 on Amazon, while his prior release, The Piano, landed in the top 20 of iTunes Classical, which right there tells you that this is a whole new world, isn't it?
It is.
Welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
And Lonnie Davis is a flutist, band leader, arts advocate, and native New Orleanian living in Charlotte, who co-founded the Charlotte-based Jazz Arts Initiative. She also produces a regularly scheduled series, The Jazz Room, at the Stage Door Theater, which is the foot of the Bank of America Tower downtown. Welcome back as well.
Thank you, Mike.
Good to see you. Now, jazz has been around, as everybody probably knows, for over 100 years. How would you describe its influence on other American music, other than jazz, and on music around the world? Who wants to take that? Kevin?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of the foundation for all American music. I mean, everything sort of has come out of it. And jazz itself is, you know, is a foundation for its own type of music. It's developed into different genres and different subgenres. And, you know, I think when you sit there and say jazz, a lot of people have one idea of what jazz is in their mind. They might think big band. Maybe they think Miles Davis. But it's kind of like saying, I want to go car shopping, and you're assuming the only car in the lot is a Model T Ford. You know, it's evolved so much over the years that it's kind of influenced itself.
And there are so many different forms of it. The list is a mile long. So how do you define it? Lonnie, since you produce all these concerts and bring all these people in, how do you define it?
How do I define jazz? You know, it's very interesting. There was a jazz audience research study done by the Doris Duke Foundation, national study, a number of different jazz institutions around the country participated, and the question was, what is jazz? And so many different audience members and people all over participated, and everyone, when you ask that question, everyone has a different answer. Mm-hmm. Jazz is so hard to define because everyone has their own perception of jazz. When you walk into a room and ask everyone, well, what is jazz? Everyone's going to have a different answer for that. So for me, jazz, in a sense, is freedom. You know, jazz can be whatever you want it to be, but it's all-encompassing, and it's freedom.
Because Chad, you've the first time we met was on this program when the Oz Sessions came out, which was... I don't want to put you in a category with other pianists, but it was more along the lines of Oscar Peterson and people like that who played, you play the melody through once and then you riff.
I'm more than happy for you to put me along with Oscar Peterson by all means.
But then you went on to do other things like this kind of new age Wyndham Hill sound for a while. Is that jazz?
For a little while. Well, I mean, and I think that's a great question because you do have to wonder, like, really, what is jazz? I had this question the other day for a blog, and they asked, how do I feel about genre labeling anymore? And do I see that if it's relevant and carry and, you know, moving forward? And I think it's really interesting because, you know, certain people have this great nostalgia about jazz. You know, you read David Sedaris, his dad was a huge jazz, just nut, just a freak, and tried to shove it down, you know, their throats as kids growing up, you know, and bought them instruments and tried to make them form this little jazz trio together. And of course, they wanted nothing to do with it until they were older. And then, you know, they're hearing Billie Holiday and instantly, you know, they start thinking of, you know, their dad, you know. And so there are moments in life, like I didn't grow up in an environment of jazz. It just wasn't around. I grew up in a really small town and wasn't introduced to jazz until college. So going back to the whole idea of labeling as far as genres are concerned, I think the generation right now that listens to Spotify, I think those are the ones that are eventually going to get rid of jazz, rock, classical. And I think what they're doing is saying, this is good. I like it. This isn't really my style.
Yeah.
I don't really care that much for it. Because if you think about it, we grew up, the four of us in this room, and I'm sure many listeners, we grew up going into a record store and then finding that little shelf that says style of music, jazz, you know, and you wouldn't venture over into country, you know, or you wouldn't venture over into rock or world music. Oh my gosh, no. You know, just complete tunnel vision.
Yeah.
But now it's just like, oh, I really like this artist. And then Spotify or Pandora, whoever you're listening to on streaming radio, for what it's worth, is going to say, oh, if you like this person, check out this person. And it's not like if you like this style of music, you'll probably want to stay in this mainstream, you know, what have you.
Well, as somebody who plays, does that then make you get into other genres of music?
Absolutely. I think you're seeing so many marriages of different artists working together that you never ever would have put together, you know. I remember years ago, it must have been on the Grammys, I think, when Dave Grohl's band, Foo Fighters, had Chick Corea up there playing with them. It's like, to your point, I think what's going on is you're beginning to see this, you know, tremendous amalgamation of artists that want to create and want to step out and push the envelope of what is just known as traditional jazz, classical rock, anything.
Going back to your record store
analogy,
years ago when I first got into this business, I worked for a station in Washington which played jazz at night. It was a regular, very conservative AM radio station in the daytime, but at night Felix Grant was there every night with the album Sound Till Midnight, and he brought the bossa nova to America, and he knew everybody in jazz. He would get off the air at midnight and he would go to every jazz club, and there were lots of jazz clubs at the time in D.C. He would go to every one of them. And he would not just play Ella Fitzgerald or Miles Davis or other people. He would bring in things that we wouldn't touch in the daytime, like Chicago, like Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Right.
And I asked him, why are you doing that? And he said, because this is fusion. Yeah. This is where jazz is influencing rock, and we need to let our listeners hear that.
Mm. And that's one of the things when you get into talking about jazz, some of the people that want to restrict jazz the most are the jazz heads that have been around for so many years. Having been a jazz radio DJ for so long, you get calls from people saying, that's not jazz. Mm. You know, but yes, it is. You know, it's a form of it. It's a branch of it. And, you know, they have the idea that jazz is, you know, it's either piano-based drums or, you know, it's a big band or it's this or it's that. But over 110 years, 120 years, it's evolved so much. There's no way to sit there and narrow it down into just
one
thing.
There are two. I think there are two uniquely American art forms. One is jazz. The other is musical theater. Musical theater fell out of favor for a very long time, particularly with young people, and now they've kind of embraced it. And I'm not sure whether it's the influence of Smash or Glee or things like that, but they've embraced it. What do you think it will take to get young people? Because this is not an unpopular art form among young people in other parts of the world. What will it take to get young people in America? into this again.
Marketing, for sure. And you and me, Mike, I mean, it comes down to what gets played on the radio and what young people get exposed to, exposure and marketing. The reason why, you know, someone like Chad could show up or another jazz musician could show up in Japan and get rock star status right when they get off the train or the plane, or go to Europe and get rock star status, is because when musicians are going over there to Europe, they're doing 5, 6, 7 interviews, then they're doing their show, then after the show's over, they're doing more interviews. Mm-hmm. Over here, we have to have an International Jazz Day show for anybody, you know, for jazz, right, to get some sort of exposure.
Because it's not on the radio. I mean, we have it on our one of our high-definition sub-channels, mm-hmm, here on WFAE. I'm not even sure which one it is because I don't own a high-definition radio and can't hear it. But I think, what are we playing on that channel? Do you know?
We're playing a variety of jazz. I'm sure it's a lot of Miles Davis, and I'm sure it's a lot of Billie Holiday and stuff like, okay, that, a lot of 50s and 60s and late 40s.
And this station used to play jazz, mm-hmm, at night.
But Bob Parlocha.
But it was called Smooth Jazz, which leads me to this exciting question. Is that jazz?
No.
Before we jump off that bridge, if we can go back to that last thing real quick, you know, Kevin, his thought process, and I agree with him about marketing, but I want to add, you know, the other side of the coin to that, which would be education.
Yeah.
And it's, I think what's happened is, and no one at this table can speak, you know, more to this than Lonnie, just because she has the Jazz Arts Initiative, which I've been gratefully a part of, you know, as far as educating these kids. And I think when you, again, going back, I didn't grow up in a jazz household, but I see a lot of these kids that are every Sunday, they're getting together to learn these tunes by Miles Davis or whoever. And I'm just like, man, if only I had that opportunity when I was that age.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're talking, what's the age group over at Jazz Arts?
From 6th grade through 12th grade.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible. So you're introducing, you know, this American art form to kids these days, and they're going to grow up with it, and they're going to realize what's good music.
Yeah.
And you know, so I think education really is the biggest key to getting.
And
this.
It probably, I don't know, I can't put myself in their shoes, but it probably sounds, particularly vocal jazz, probably sounds foreign to them, because the vocalists that sing jazz can really sing.
Yeah.
As opposed to some people who are involved in other genres, who make it because they have 3 really good notes and auto-tune. So what is young people's what's their reaction when they first hear a Dede Bridgewater or somebody like Diane Shore or somebody like that?
You know, I think they really, really do get it. And one thing that, excuse me, one thing we try to teach is the importance of singing jazz and being able to sing what you hear before you play it, because your voice is your first instrument, and if you can sing it, then you can play it. And so your voice is very important aspect, you know, as a jazz musician. And so when they hear jazz vocalists, I think they really understand and they can really appreciate that. And we actually have a couple of really great young jazz vocalists in our program.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk more about this Jazz Arts Initiative, because it does involve young people. And I want to talk about that as we go through it, and also the summer camp as well. When we come back, I want to talk about where this all began. Since you're a New Orleanian, if that's how you say it, I will let you take credit for it. I'll let the city of New Orleans take credit for it. But I want to find out more about where it began. And then we're going to also hear from a jazz artist that you spoke to.
Yeah.
Into Kevin in just a couple of minutes here. Christian Scott. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about jazz on International Jazz Day, April 30th, the 4th annual International Jazz Day, with Kevin Kniestad, our Morning Edition host here at WFAE, who spent years as a jazz host and jazz blogger in Seattle. Chad Lawson is here, a musician who will not be categorized. And Lonnie Davis, president and CEO of the Jazz Arts Initiative. I want to remind folks that we actually do have jazz on the radio in Charlotte, and it's on WFAE HD2. You can also hear it on our website at WFAE.org and on the WFAE app. My gosh, where would we be without the app? You can hear jazz legends like Miles Davis and John Coltrane and Dizzy Gillespie and Ella Fitzgerald, Thelonious Monk, Billie Holiday, Dave Brubeck, and more. The list goes on and on. So if you're a fan of that and you've been searching for it, that's where it is. Where did it begin? In New Orleans? You want to take credit for this?
I think, yes, absolutely. The city of New Orleans, and specifically Congo Square, which is right outside, back in the day, Congo Square was right outside of the old city, which was the French Quarters. Mm-hmm. So right north of the French Quarters is an area of land that is now called Louis Armstrong Park. It's on the National Registry. But this space, on Sundays, during the time when the Spanish controlled New Orleans, they believed in allowing their enslaved people on Sunday to have a day of rest. Uh-huh. And so these folks were allowed to congregate in this space now called Congo Square and just congregate, socialize, and of course, music, drums were a big part of it. And I think what makes New Orleans so special is that every other place in this country banned the use of or the playing of drums except in New Orleans. Wow. And so these different people from these different tribes in Africa were able to bring in all of their cultures, bring in their drums. They played bells. They played banjos. They played all these other instruments. And they danced and sung. And it just really helped to keep, you know, the culture alive. And then by New Orleans being a port city, it also had a lot of influences from European, you know, brass bands and other cultural influences. And that all came together. And that's how jazz was born.
Well, Kevin mentioned marketing, and I read a promotion piece by the city of New Orleans about this yesterday. And whoever wrote this gets a gold star. They say that jazz started as the bright flash of European horns running into the dark rumble of African drums like lightning meeting thunder.
Oh, wow.
I just thought that was terrific.
That's pretty awesome.
And then they go on to say that jazz wasn't born on a particular day, but over a period of time, not just by one person or one race. It is a meeting, a mixing of essences and emotions of many people and cultures.
Yes. It's like gumbo.
Which is why it makes it so special, which I guess is why it is appealing around the world, right?
Absolutely. And jazz is, you know, is our gift to the world.
So that jazz that started over the course of not one day, but 2 days in New Orleans, would you have called that Dixieland jazz back then or even today? Or if we heard that those pieces of music, could we classify it as that, or did that evolve over time?
I think it evolved over time. It didn't start as Dixieland jazz. Uh-huh. I think, you know, and God knows what the very first form of jazz actually sounded like. And, you know, if you read up, you know, Jelly Roll Morton will try to take credit for inventing jazz altogether.
Yeah.
But, you know, those earliest styles of jazz, I think it you know, preceded Dixieland. And, I mean, I would love to hear what was coming out of Congo Square back, you know, 150 years ago.
Well, you know, in the early days of rock and roll, white musicians co-opted the music of black performers. Elvis Presley would do cover tunes, but he would have the hit of things originated by black performers. White musicians like Benny Goodman, who we opened the program with, Bix Beiderbecke, later Dave Brubeck, Paul Desmond, all white. Did they steal from African Americans, or did they just massage it?
They contributed to the whole. I definitely would say that they did not steal, because the essence of jazz is collaboration and, you know, all of, you know, everyone having a voice, you know, and so I think that's exactly what they did.
The other interesting thing I think about jazz is that, unlike rock and roll, is that when rock came out, you had to have an Elvis do the song, or it wasn't going to be popular with white audiences. And yet, during the entire history of jazz, people like Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong, Joe Williams, Count Basie, you name them, Duke Ellington, they had white followings at a time when that simply wasn't possible in the world. How do you explain that?
I think jazz breaks barriers. I mean, one of the very first huge megastars of jazz was Scott Joplin. And I think a lot of it had to do with his creative works and what he was doing. I mean, his sheet music, you know, I was reading a thing the other day, his sheet music sold in the millions. And just because he had created something that was unique, and was new. And I think that's really the fascinating thing about jazz, especially instrumental jazz, mm-hmm. when you're not hearing a singer. So you really can't tell. There is no definition of color of, you know, is this person white? Is this person black? Is this person whatever? When you're actually just listening to someone just play in a quartet setting, you know, so you have no preconceived ideas. And I think that's truly beautiful.
It also became a big thing in New York, too, you know, with hipsters, not like today's hipster, but the hipsters back then.
The curly mustache.
Yeah. to go into neighborhoods and go into traditionally African-American clubs and go listen to the music there and go into neighborhoods that they might have not gone into before. And, you know, that's really where a lot of the crossover came from, too.
One of the things that jazz musicians seem to have gotten a really good handle on in terms of perpetrating the music, moving it into the next generation, is that since I was a kid, there were jazz camps. There's still jazz camps. You run a jazz camp here in the summertime. That's what the Jazz Arts Music Camp is in June. What happens at these camps, and who are these young people, and how do they get involved, and all that stuff?
Oh, wow. So it's 1 week of comprehensive and pretty intense but very fun learning. So this year's camp is June 16th through 20th, and this is actually the first year we're doing it at the UNC Charlotte Center City campus. So it's going to be an amazing facility, and we have some of the best jazz educators in this area and outside of this area coming in, and they teach these kids some really amazing things about the history of jazz combo playing, jazz improvisation, and lots of other really cool things.
Are these kids already accomplished players, or are they beginners? What are they looking for when they go to these master classes, essentially, with these people?
So the really cool thing about our jazz camp is that we invite students on all levels of playing, as long as they have at least 1 year of music training. Does not have to be jazz at all, but as long as they come in with some proficiency on their instrument, we can certainly take it from there. And we get a wide range of students from all over the area and outside of Mecklenburg County.
And one of the people that you're bringing in this summer is a man by the name of Christian Scott, who you may have seen on Tremé on HBO, among other things, but he is well known around the world, and here's a little bit of his music. Grammy-nominated jazz trumpeter Christian Scott, who is coming this summer to be part of the Jazz Arts Music Camp. And you were saying off the air, Chad, that this is an example of somebody taking somebody else's jazz work and repurposing it, essentially.
Exactly. This is a Miles Davis from Kinda Blue. And the song title is called So What. And I actually am not familiar with this, with Christian's album. I'm very familiar who he is as a player, but instantly within hearing two notes, I'm like, oh, that's old, you know, Miles's old tune. And so what he's done is he's taking, I can't remember what year, Kinda Blue.
59.
So he's taken a tune from 59 and then has made it more of a modern style right now. I mean, listen to the drums. You've got that, you know, really cool funk beat kind of going on. It's kind of groovy, and it's putting today's spin on such a classic from 59.
And Christian Scott's one of these guys. He's 30, 31 years old. And I think Christian's really like the new and upcoming face of jazz. He's progressive. He does a lot of his own stuff. This is an example of him doing somebody else's stuff, but it's modern. He probably always thinks he's the best musician in the room, no matter what genre he's playing in, and he's right. And, you know, he's kind of that forward face of jazz. Yeah.
And you had a chance to talk to him yesterday, as a matter of fact, Kevin, and it now seems as good a time as any to hear that conversation.
So you're from New Orleans originally, and of course a lot of people associate jazz with New Orleans, but jazz really takes on a whole different meaning down there, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, this is something that is really a part of life here. You know, you can't really turn a corner without seeing something that's associated with this music or hearing something that's associated with this music. So, I mean, but, you know, I guess that would make sense because it's from here. But I, you know, I've just moved back here recently, so I'm enjoying sort of being around that type of energy again.
How important was the New Orleans music and culture in you deciding to become a musician in the first place?
Well, my family is, you know, is a family of artists and musicians, folk singers, and educators. So, you know, since I was a little boy, I was sort of, you know, my house was sort of inundated with the sounds and you know, cultural things that really come from this music. You know, I couldn't really go from one room to another without either, you know, having my grandfather stop me and ask me about what I heard, thought about, you know, a Dizzy Gillespie solo. Or speaking to my mother, and, you know, she would be singing something or writing something, you know, checking out some music that she was into or whatever. So, you know, it was really, you know, growing up in an environment like that, I was surrounded by music, you know, so it wasn't just the city, it was also in my home. So I think that was really instrumental in me making the choice to be a musician because, you know, my music, my life was really inundated with music.
What's the biggest misconception that people have about jazz music?
Well, I think now the main misconception that exists now is that, you know, jazz music is like their grandparents' music. And I think a lot of people have sort of come to sort of these conclusions that, you know, like jazz music is like fuddy-duddy music or something, for lack of a better term. And it's like the music of, like, old people and walkers or whatever. And it doesn't mean that, you know, older generations are not... you know, of course it is their music to a certain degree as well, but I think there's some really, you know, some really great music that's coming out of what the younger generation is doing, not just in New Orleans, but all over the world. You know, you could argue that this music is, you know, probably the most loved music all over the world. You know, there's a jazz festival in every city, and, you know, we... You know, I go on tour maybe 6 to 8 months out of the year. We're almost always gone. And when we go to all these places, whether it's the Canary Islands or if we go to Marrakesh or we go to Brazil or if we're in Tokyo or wherever we are, you know, we don't just see older people at our concerts. Like, everyone loves the music. There's, you know, small children there, the teenagers there, to also people in their 80s. So I think the main misconception is that, you know, in America, the main misconception is just that this music belongs to a previous generation, when what's great about it is that it's cross-generational.
I was going to ask you about that. I've talked to a lot of jazz musicians that have said that when they go to Asia or they go to Europe, they almost get, like, you know, the Beatles rock star treatment. And it's
here. They know us better than a lot of times. You know, sometimes you might go to Europe and there's more people there that may know, you know, me or like Robert Glasper or somebody like that than may know Kanye West. But in America, that's hard to believe because, you know, the jazz musicians here or the musicians that play this music in America, they don't get that type of recognition in America, where a lot of times you use the word jazz and you immediately become persona non grata and sort of knocked out of certain types of resources in the music, in the American music business or model. So it's, you know, it's always kind of, it's funnier to us and sort of, you know, we joke about it a lot on the road, where it's just like in America, you know, everyone looks at you, you're almost relegated to playing these rooms that, you know, can hold 400, 500 people max. But, you know, you go to England and you're playing the Barbican or Royal Albert Hall. And so it's really strange that, you know, a lot of musicians here have really had to run to Europe or South America or to Asia also just to be able to support themselves, because, you know, a lot of the American audience has written it off.
You're going to be in Charlotte in June as a guest for the Jazz Arts Initiative Jazz Arts Music Camp. When it comes to educating young musicians about jazz, what's the message you want to get across to them?
A lot of times when young students are learning in the general conservatory model, which is kind of the largest model in terms of jazz education these days, they're told to, you know, if you play the trumpet, you're told to listen to Miles Davis, Clifford Brown, Dizzy Gillespie, and Freddie Hubbard, and to study what they did, and if you do that well enough, then you'll be able to play jazz, right? And I think a lot of times the model that we use is very limiting, right? Because, like, when I was growing up, I was always told, I wasn't told just to listen to Miles and Dizzy and Clifford Brown. I was also told to listen to Kenny Dorham and to listen to Fats Navarro and to listen to Booker Little and to listen to Tommy Turrentine and to listen to Cat Anderson and to listen to Harry Sweets Edison and to listen to every person that actually played the trumpet that I could find was a resource for me, because it's going to be very hard to compete with someone that's listened to 70 trumpet players if you only cop stuff from four. But I think on a general level, the main thing that I like to impart to young musicians is that they shouldn't be afraid to express themselves the way they express themselves. I think a lot of times in the system of how we educate young musicians, 9 times out of 10, we go about the business of washing away all of the things that actually make them a unique musician as a means of being able to get them to play on a certain level. And I think it depends. It basically harkens back to how you articulate these things to kids. Imagine if Dizzy Gillespie had accepted when they told him not to puff his cheeks out, right?
Yeah.
So the thing is that we have with this form of music, it is such a creative music and such a personal music that we have to also be careful of what things we attack young students about in their developing.
Christian Scott, composer and Grammy-nominated trumpeter, will be a guest at the Jazz Arts Music Camp in June. Thanks again for taking the time to talk today.
No worries. It's a pleasure.
He will also be performing on June 19th, 2 shows at the Jazz Room, which is the stage door theater at the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center. And that's open to the public. That's not just for the jazz camps and for the kids. It's for
right.
adults as well. We're talking about jazz on this 4th annual International Jazz Day. We'll talk about why this is International Jazz Day. And I want to talk to our musician here, Chad Lawson, about what goes through his mind while he's playing. We're coming right back.
Sheer terror.
That's right. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins on International Jazz Day with 3 jazz aficionados. I think you only say that with jazz and classical. Lonnie Davis is president and CEO of the Jazz Arts Initiative. Chad Lawson is a musician, a fantastic musician, who should be not sitting in this studio. He should be out playing someplace big. And Kevin Kniestad, former jazz host and, of course, our host of Morning Edition here on WFAE. Why is this International Jazz Day? It's the 4th annual one. Whose idea was this? When did it come about and why?
It's kind of Herbie Hancock's baby. And, it was a way to, you know, kind of put jazz on a worldwide stage. The concert that they do every year, it's probably the biggest jazz concert in the world. It has the biggest names in jazz performing in it. And it is, in fact, it just got over about an hour or so ago from Osaka, Japan this year is where they were doing it. And, you know, Wayne Shorter was playing, and Kenny Garrett, Roy Hargrove, Esperanza Spalding, Marcus Miller, a lot of great musicians. And it's also a way, you know, to just kind of not only just to expose jazz to the world, but, you know, to just, you know, educate and show the culture of jazz to the world via web stream and things like that.
Yeah. Last year, the host city was Istanbul. Mm-hmm. This year, Osaka, Japan, which is really interesting to me, not the United States. But the whole point is that it's an American art form that crosses cultural boundaries and opens doors to conversation. You went to Japan with your trio years ago, mm-hmm. and were...
Yeah, it was fascinating.
How would you describe what happened to you at customs?
Yeah, I thought it was a joke. You know, I started looking for the candid cameras. You know, the trio, Al Sergel on drums and Zach Page on bass, we went over to Japan to do some shows. And going through security at the airport, I beg your pardon, they had the drummer, Al, open up a cymbal bag. And so they see these cymbals, and his response was, well, yeah, you know, I'm a drummer. We play jazz. We play American jazz. And their eyes lit up like you would not believe. And they were just so excited. And they went and got their other coworkers, and they came over, and they're like, look, these guys play jazz. They play American jazz. And it was just – it was a huge event. And we're just trying to get through security at the airport, you know. I mean, so over there – the idea of Europeans and the Asian area loving music, it's so true. I mean, it's like, I don't know if it's just ingrained in them since early youth or what, but they just love music.
You wanted to be, I'm told, a musician at the age of 5.
Mm-hmm.
a jazz musician or just a musician?
Just a musician. Yeah, I grew up watching Sean and Ah on television. I'm not kidding you. I mean, I know it's my wife and my folks are so tired of hearing the story, but you know, they used to have a TV show.
Yes, they did.
And I had no idea what the guy was doing. He was like just pounding on something, and I'm like, that's what I want to do. And so they came to town, and that was my first concert. And so my parents rented a piano because they were like, okay, this is going to last, 6 months? And I haven't stopped since.
So when did you decide that you wanted to play jazz?
Not until I was practically in college. Basically, I was brought up very strict classical. Mm-hmm. And then a local band needed someone to do some wedding dates, as far as a wedding band is concerned. So I started learning all these pop and then country. And then long story short, I really wanted to go into being a studio musician. I wanted to learn how to play everything really well. And then jazz was one of those things where it was just like the top of the layer,
Well, we probably talked about this the very first time you were on the show. I think classical music training is great training to be a jazz musician because you learn theory and you learn chord structure and you learn riffs that you can actually purloin from Bach and Mozart and put them in jazz and you sound brilliant.
Well, right, and technique.
Technique, exactly.
But, to your point, and it's really interesting you bring that up. I mean, if you look at Charlie Parker and you look at Bach, there is so much similarity there. It's uncanny. To get a little on the theory side, when Charlie Parker was playing, I'm going to go into some music geekery here. A lot of his downbeats were chord tones of what he was playing. So if he's playing like a C chord, a lot of the downbeats of the music were outlining that chord. And if you go back and you look at Bach, it's the same thing. I used to study with Fred Hirsch, and we would talk about theory. And he says, go buy a Bach chorale book. There's 371 chorales. And he says, just play those every day for a year. And he goes, that's all the theory you're ever going to need to know. And it's so true. You're learning structure, and you're learning how melodies kind of intertwine with each other. It's not as divorced as what you would think it would be as far as jazz and classical. It's really they're really pretty married pretty well.
Not to harken back to days of yesteryear, but when we first met, you were on this program because you had just released, you and your trio, the Chad Lawson Trio, had just released your Oz sessions. And I want to play something from that, which is still being played all the time.
It is.
Everywhere, in the grocery store, in the elevator. It's amazing.
Don't forget the dentist office.
And the dentist office. Now, that was in 2002. It's still being played around the world. It was on One Tree Hill or one of those shows that was done at Wilmington. Was it One Tree Hill or was it Dawson's Creek?
Dawson's Creek.
Is there a difference?
Yeah, there's no difference.
It's the same show.
Did the success of this surprise you?
It did, actually, because it's funny, with jazz, we decided as a trio that we were not going to get into the game of competing with other trios. Okay? So that album did extremely well, and the album after that did extremely well. Like, we were like number 7 on the national jazz charts, and we were befuddled by the idea because you had artists at the same time, Brad Meldow, Cyrus Chestnut was really up there, and we were like, I don't understand this. But we had the mindset from day one to create, not compete.
Now, you've never played this the same way twice, I'm sure. So when you listen back to 2002, which was 150 years ago, this probably sounds foreign to you. But what is going through your mind? It's one thing to play the melody. We all know the melody to Off to See the Wizard. And even there, you're putting a couple of your own little touches in there. But when you go off, when you get into the jazz riff,
right?
What's going
right.
through your head?
That's a great question, because in jazz, you're taught to learn it really well and then forget it.
Mm-hmm.
So because if you're tied down, I was in a session one day, it's a session in New York, and this guitar player was like, I don't know what to do with the solo. Should I do mixolydian? Should I do super lydian? Should I do super? And he was naming off all this stuff. And I said, dude, just play the music. Just play what, in the words of David Gilmour, play what you feel and ignore everything else. And that's kind of what happens when you're playing jazz. You're kind of, you're just hearing, okay, so here's the program. I'm listening to what the drummer and the bass player are doing. And I'm trying to have a conversation with them. And I'm trying not to talk too much. And I'm also trying to interject and just balance. And if you've worked on your craft well enough to where you don't have to think about the technical aspects of it, then you can just kind of paint in a roundabout way.
That's what I like about your music. It's tasty.
Thanks.
And tasteful.
I appreciate
different
that.
Different thing, but it's just you play enough notes and not too many.
You know why?
Just the right amount of notes.
Like all those wedding bands and everything I played in, I was so young, and they kept saying to me, stop playing so much, stop playing so much. And so really, that was my youth. And each gig, each date, I finally learned, play less.
So we let you play more. You're an independent artist. That means you don't necessarily have a label that you're mm-hmm. signed mm-hmm. to and obligated to.
Right.
Is that a good thing? And obviously, this is a conscious decision you have made.
It is a conscious decision. And it's a delicate balance, because you have to decide what you want to do. You know, every artist out there that's listening, you have to wake up one morning and write down what your agenda is,
mm-hmm.
you know? Are you okay with just playing gigs around town?
Well, you just turned down a major record label who wanted you to tour, 200 days a year?
It was 200 days a year.
And you said no, because you didn't want to tour 200 days a year?
I love to travel. I hate leaving home. You know, I really do. Hang with me here. I have a beautiful wife who hangs the moon every night after dinner, and I have two boys that are just the light of my life. So, you know, anytime I'm leaving, our oldest son is 3.5. And so whenever he sees me leaving, he asks, well, where are you going? I say, well, I'm going to work. His first question is it far away? And that's really difficult. And so what I'm trying to do is balance performing, which I love to do
right. Everywhere
around the world. So you try to balance that. And then you also try to have a family life.
But you said to me off the air that this is something that every young musician
mm-hmm.
aspiring musician
absolutely
dreams of.
Absolutely.
And here, this is, how difficult was it to say no?
You know what? It was actually not as difficult as no, and that's a lie. It was really difficult. There's two things a musician always wants to do. A musician wants to play with a large artist in front of thousands of people. So the very first time I walked on stage with Julio Iglesias, I couldn't stop smiling. It was 35,000 people. And I literally had to tell myself, shut your face. You know, you have to act like this was like, you know, every night. It's a day gig for you.
Yeah.
You know, so I did that. And that was the most unbelievable feeling in the entire world. And the second thing that every musician wants is to be signed to a major label,
right?
You know, because then that's instant recognition throughout the world if it's with a major, and it really puts you out there.
Is the upside of being an independent artist being able to do anything you want to do? You're not going to be pigeonholed by some label who said, well, your last album sold 1 million copies, so you must do the exact same album again with different songs.
That's exactly it. Like the upcoming release I've done is I've taken 10 Chopin pieces and I've put them in a modern spin with piano, violin, and cello. And it's extremely creative. But what if I had submitted that to someone and they spilled coffee on their lap or something, or they were in a foul mood, and they listened to it and they said, you know what, this isn't for us.
But if you become a million-selling artist for a big label, don't you eventually get the artistic freedom to do what – I don't think anybody told Duke Ellington what he could or couldn't play, did
I think it was. I think it was a different time back then. Okay. Like today's structure of the record label is what they call a 360 deal. And what happens with a 360 deal is the record label takes a percentage of everything, not just record sales, not merchandise sales, everything. So if you approach the label and say, hey, there's this great opportunity that I would like to do, and they say, no, don't go do it, and you go do it anyway, and you make $1 million, well, guess what? They're getting a percentage of that $1 million. And so what we're seeing now is the record label is kind of in a relatively crisis mode, and so they're trying to find any way they can to find funds. And so, you know, this whole new idea of a 360 deal is really difficult for artists.
Kevin, you have made a list of 10 albums, suggested starter albums for people who may not have a lot of experience with jazz. And I'm going to go through the list a little bit and talk about Time Out, Dave Brubeck, classic album. Why that one?
Take Five, which is one of the tracks on there, was the first jazz single to sell 1 million copies ever. It's a great classic album. We also have What Kind of Blue is on there from Miles Davis, also from 1959, actually, probably the best year in jazz. Maybe Kind of Blue came out from Miles Davis, Time Out from Dave Brubeck. You had Giant Steps from John Coltrane. I think Monk had three albums out in 1959.
And you chose Ella and Louie, which is Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong, as they had such a long and prolific, they had such long prolific careers. Why that album?
I think it's two of the most important voices in the history of jazz, in the history of American music, and you get to hear them together, two of the most unique
in
voices.
In their prime.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Bird and Dizzy Gillespie, Bird and Diz is the name of the album. It's Charlie Parker, who was known as Bird, and Dizzy Gillespie together.
Those guys just have always, you know, no matter how many times I've listened to them, and I listened to them 100 times, you know, when you're a jazz radio DJ, you play them 1 million times. Those guys, it's just an education every single time on how to improvise, how to listen to each other, and how to perform.
And may I suggest Super Sax plays Bird.
Oh.
To me, that is just, I mean, it's a group of saxophone players who are playing the solos of Charlie Parker, but as a group.
That's not an easy task.
Wow.
Not an easy task.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Lady Sings the Blues. Not the Diana Ross version, but Billie Holiday.
Diana Ross acted as Billie Holiday once, I believe.
Yes, she did.
But you got to get some Billie Holiday in there, too. Again, one of the most unique voices and a true treasure to American music.
We'll post that. We've only touched on this top 10 list of things to start with, and we'll post that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. So the Jazz Room goes on at the Stage Door Theater each month, and the next one is what, May 20th?
Yes.
With the Spartan Jazz Collective, and they're playing the music of Max Roach.
Yes.
And then Christian Scott will be here June 19th. Brian Miller playing Charlie Parker on the 25th of July. Lynn Grissett playing Lee Morgan on August 22nd. And then Ryan Serenich plays George Gershwin on September 19th. Nice. We'll put that on our website, too. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you
for having us.